A phone with flashy bright lights and 8 speakers. A phone with a massive battery, falsely labeled, of course. Olympics-branded phones, cigarette pack phones, and of course, the Motorola. The mid-2000s saw the wild and woolly rise of a bandit phone industry in the People's Republic of China. Fueled by incredible consumer demand for mobile phones, a faulty regulatory system, and a Taiwanese chip maker. Whatever happened to those companies? Why couldn't they compete? In today's video, the mid-2000s and the wave of Chinese bandit phones. But first, the Asianometry Patreon. Early access members get to see new videos first, and it really helps a lot. It's one of the best ways to support the channel directly. I deeply appreciate all of you. Thank you, and on with the show. In 1992, 4 Chinese university students led by Xu Lihua started a company. They saw that Chinese people were rapidly adopting beepers, but all the existing beepers on the market were from abroad, so their company would make Chinese beepers in China for other Chinese. Since they wanted their company to break out of its shell and soar, they named it Bird. In case you're wondering, beepers, or pagers if you swing that way, are an older technology. Your typical beeper receives a message and then beeps you. You can then go to a telephone to respond to the message. They got to be a bit of a status symbol in the 1990s. Bird raised money from a local town government and produced their first beepers in May 1993. Shortages in Motorola beepers let Bird capture a small market niche. In 1998, the peak of the beeper market in China, Bird sold 325,000 beepers. In the late 1990s, beepers declined as consumers shifted to simple 2G mobile phones. Today, you would call these feature phones. Bird's management sensed this shift as these phones gained popularity in Hong Kong and Korea and decided to make their own mobile phones. But it wasn't as easy as just doing it. At that time, the Chinese government required that every mobile phone maker be approved via a license. The licenses were highly limited. Between 1998 and 2005, the ministry licensed just 35 domestic and 14 foreign phone manufacturers. And to protect domestic companies, the foreign companies had to export 60% of their production. This created a bit of a market gap. People wanted or preferred a reputable Nokia phone, but there was not enough supply. Certain unscrupulous Chinese companies realized they can make a quick buck by imitating, i.e. counterfeiting, these reputable phones. Bird, on the other hand, decided to try and build a brand of their own. They partnered with a state-owned company for a legitimate mobile phone license. And to acquire the mobile phone technology, Bird struck a deal with a French communications conglomerate called Sagem. In September 1999, Bird launched the Mirage RC-838. Made with a French mobile chip, its name is derived from the French fighter jet and thus gives birth to the slogan, "The Fighter Jet of Mobile Phones." The Mirage sold 700,000 units in 2000, becoming the top domestic phone model. Bird then launches dozens of new models like the S series with its popular S1000. To sell their phones, Bird aggressively poured money into marketing and sales. For instance, they bought a phone endorsement from the late great Hong Konger singer Coco Lee before the phone in question ever came out. Thanks to these efforts, Bird became one of China's first leading domestic phone brands, alongside another company called TCL. Some market estimates had Bird in third place in 2002 with 9.7% market share behind only the dominant foreign companies Motorola and Nokia. They were also the only relevant Chinese phone exporter. In December 2002, they sold their 10 millionth phone. The Bird was flying high. Now let us pause a bit. I want to take a time to introduce a new character to this radio drama, the chip designer MediaTek, or MTK. MTK had once been part of the legendary United Microelectronics Corporation, or UMC. UMC was founded as a fully integrated design manufacturer, like Intel, meaning that they designed and fabbed their own semiconductors. UMC started off relatively successfully, but then came TSMC and its independent foundry business model. In 1995, UMC spun off their chip design units to become a foundry too. MediaTek was one of those spin-offs. Several others are still around in Taiwan's chip design industry today. Like Novatek, which makes LCD display drivers and image sensors, or ITE Tech, which makes I/O and flash memory control chips. MediaTek began operations in May 1997 with a team of just 35 people led by Minkai Tsai. Tsai joined UMC from the Research Institute ITRI in 1983, and over the years he worked his way up to an R&D director position overseeing memory, consumer, and multimedia. Many MTK employees had previously worked on UMC's graphic chips, one of the company's few product disappointments. Maybe that lingering smell of failure was why UMC took a smaller stake in MTK compared to its siblings like Novatek. I reckon it left a chip on their shoulders. At the start, MTK's intention was to produce chipsets for multimedia, also called optical storage. But which format? One chipset MTK had in development was for a home video format called Video CD, or VCD. VCD was quite popular in parts of Asia outside of Japan and Korea. A lot of these VCDs were used for karaoke video audio content before those switched to Laserdisc. The VCD product, however, was late, and the market too mature anyway, so MTK turned to CD-ROM. By 1996, the format was gaining popularity after being integrated into desktop and laptop PCs. In 1997, 60 million CD-ROM units would be sold. Now, the CD-ROM chip market was intensely competitive, but also fragmented. Significant players included Oak Technology in the United States, Philips in the Netherlands, and Panasonic, Toshiba, and Sony in Japan. Despite starting from behind, MTK decided that it can still enter and succeed in this market if it can bring a product that costs way less but offers more. The way to such a product would be integration, the hallmark of semiconductor economics. To understand what MTK did, we must briefly discuss a CD-ROM system. A CD encodes data using a sequence of deep pits and flat areas called LANs on its surface. The CD-ROM drive uses a laser to read that data off the disk. We can split its components into what we call a front and back end. The front end is a mixed signal chipset that controls the drive's optical mechanism. It manages the movements of the laser head and the spindle motor spinning the optical disk to ensure that data can be accurately read off the disk. After that, the CD-ROM's back end decodes the video and audio data. It converts that raw data into formats that the computer can use and also applies error correction to fix any mistakes. What MTK introduced was a chipset for the CD-ROM front end. Their first chipset was special because it reduced the number of chips in the set to 2. Other competitors had 3, 4, or even as many as 6 chips. This is classic integration at work. For CD-ROM drive makers like ASUS, Lite-On, and BTC, not Bitcoin, fewer chips meant simpler PCB designs, less assembly work, and cheaper component costs. This in turn leads to cheaper CD-ROM drives for consumers. MTK's second headlining feature was that its chipset could do 20 times the original CD-ROM speed of 1,550 kilobits per second. Higher playback speeds let computers read data faster off the disk and thus reduce waiting times. With competing mainstream products and only capable of 4 to 8 times speeds, MTK's new chipset spun heads. When the competition inevitably caught up, MTK released new chipsets with faster playback speeds at lower prices. By 2000, they had become dominant in the CD-ROM and CD-RW markets, with 60% market share, vanquishing competitors like Oak Technology. They then expanded into DVD players and burners, securing 50% share by 2002. They did a similar strategy as with CDs, offering a chipset that reduced the number of discrete chips while also offering new features like multiple disk format compatibility and faster playback. Manufacturers like the American Electronics Trading Company, Apex Digital, bought these systems on chips to sell DVD players at half the price of competitors. The business of powering these CD and DVD players was quite a good one for MTK, with net income margins of 40% or higher. In the early 2000s, MTK surpassed VIA Technologies to become Taiwan's most profitable publicly traded tech company. In a 25th anniversary article, Chairman Tsai recalled making the decision to go into mobile back in 2000/2001, as MTK was still competing in the CD and DVD industries. Mobile was then becoming a very real trend. In 2001, nearly 400 million mobile feature phones were sold. Tsai believed that the mobile communications industry, with phones at the center, presented a bigger opportunity than optical storage. So they were just following the big trend. Mobile phone supply chains in the early 2000s involved three major players: the chipset manufacturer, the handset manufacturer, and the telecom. The chipset includes the analog radio frequency components that send and receive radio waves, the baseband CMOS processor that handles the radio functions for calls, texts, and data, and application processors for functions like playing media files, doing cameras, and loading web pages. Back then, top chipset makers included Qualcomm and Texas Instruments from the United States, with TI being the biggest, as well as Infineon from Europe. The handset manufacturers are companies like Nokia and Motorola. They're essentially system integrators who buy the chipsets and design handsets around them. They also handle assembly, build quality, user interface, and branding. The telecoms provide the cellular network service. They buy the handsets for resale to the public, and so have a lot of say in how the handsets might look or perform. American companies like Motorola were then outsourcing handset manufacturing to Taiwanese assemblers like BenQ, Compal, and Arima Communications. But since no Taiwanese company provided mobile chipsets, those handset makers had to import the chips from Texas Instruments. So MTK took the plunge. Development took over 3 years. In late 2003, MTK released its first baseband 2G GSM chipsets, and pretty much no one bought them. They sold a few chipsets to second-rate Taiwanese handset assemblers like Lite-On, but most stuck with their established Western suppliers. This was apparently because MTK's first-generation chipsets, products like the MT6205, were very basic. The hot trend at the time was 3G and wireless data. MTK's first chips did not even support 2.5G GPRS data transfer. They also could not access mobile internet web pages or play media files like MP3. Who would want such a phone? In 2004, MTK sold 3.2 million phone chips, a pittance considering 600 plus million phones were sold that year. The year also saw a major decline in MTK's cash cow DVD player and drive industries. This, plus the heavy investments into phone chip development, led to significant margin declines in 2004. What can the company do? Now, we return to mainland China at a fascinating time in its history. In the 1990s, restructurings of state-owned enterprises caused millions of Chinese to lose their jobs. Many became migrant entrepreneurs, setting up small, informal workshops. These workshops had the will and desire to make things people wanted, like handsets, but lacked technical knowledge. And traditional Western companies like Texas Instruments had little interest in catering their products to the needs of the local Chinese market. And then in 2004, the Chinese government recognized the folly of its strict licensing regime for mobile phones and replaced it with a more lenient approval system. MTK recognized the opportunity and in 2005 introduced the turnkey model. They designed a highly integrated chipset with all the basic mobile phone features, along with features like image processing and MP3 file playback. The latter became particularly popular. They then bundled that chipset with a technical blueprint of a basic cell phone called a reference design. The design included some hardware like a PCB and schematic. The only thing left to do is to assemble it with a screen and a plastic shell. And as for software, MTK offered a basic mobile phone operating system. Its core was an embedded OS called Nucleus RTOS, first released in 1993. On top of that, MTK layered on a special GUI called the MediaTek Advanced User Interface, or MAUI. So what MediaTek was in effect doing was drastically lowering the barrier for making a mobile phone by selling simple assembly kits. They were not the only ones doing this. There were the Chinese companies Spreadtrum and HiSilicon, Texas Instruments and Qualcomm tried it too, though they failed. MTK led the league. In 1 year, their share of Chinese mobile chipsets skyrocketed from 0 to 40%. These Chinese workshops, most of which were based in Shenzhen's Hua Changbei district, did not make and sell the MTK reference design as is. That would not be a very smart business decision. There was no differentiation. Instead, they engaged local designers and engineers to add special, unique features on top of the reference design to make something brand new. Today, we know many of these phones as Sanzai. It was said that these early Shenzhen phone manufacturers were embarrassed to say their product was from Shenzhen, so they instead printed SZ. SZ became Sanzai, or so that story goes. But the term actually far predates the phones. In Hong Kong, in the 1960s and 1970s, Sanzai factories were small, family-owned workshops that subcontracted for garment and plastics factories. Their work was heavily manual, assembling plastic flowers, sewing garments, and trimming threads, and they worked out of either old residential buildings or wooden huts in squatter areas on Hong Kong's hillsides. Sanzai literally means mountain fortress and refers to a famous Ming Dynasty Chinese novel called Water Margin. It's a long novel, but the story follows over 100 bandits who hang out at a mountain and fight crime and corruption. It evokes the image of being on the outskirts, self-sufficient and rebelling against the mainstream. So the English translation, bandit, probably makes sense here. And these phone workshops were then breaking the law by putting out phones without proper licenses and mobile network certification. MTK chairman Tsai has said in an interview that he prefers referring to them as white box phones rather than bandit, which carried a more negative connotation. It is true that many Sanzai workshops copied the designs, features, and even names of reputable companies, but they also gave us some truly unique pieces. There were bombastic phones with ultra-flashy LED lights or very loud speakers. These were popular with farmers working in loud environments and youths in the rural areas where 30 to 50% of these phones were sold to. Sanzai phones pioneered multi-SIM slots, capable of holding 2, 3, or even 4 SIM cards long before it went mainstream. Using this, users can easily switch between different carrier plans for better coverage or cost. There was a solar-powered mobile phone, presumably made for those living without easy access to electricity. There was a phone with a huge telephoto lens attached to its digital camera. This was apparently made to cater to either photography enthusiasts or perverts. With an MTK chipset, a workshop can take a phone concept from paper to reality in just about 2 to 3 months. Rough estimates at the time found that 2 to 3 new feature phones were being released into the market each day. The fast time to market meant that workshops can ride trending topics for a quick buck. In the run-up to the 2008 Beijing Olympics, they made phones with designs inspired by the National Aquatic Center, or the Bird's Nest Stadium, or the mascot Fua. A super fun phone was the Buddha Light Phone, which targeted Chinese Buddhists with design elements inspired by Buddhist art, as well as a hardware slot to attach golden Buddhist charms against evil. Another favorite is the cigarette pack feature phone. Since cigarettes are a regular part of Chinese business culture, the phone was apparently popular amongst businessmen who found it a novel conversation starter. Nowadays, Chinese internet users nostalgically celebrate these knockoffs for their cheapness, creative tweaks, and just general wild nature. It was a great way to express your individuality. It was a true Cambrian explosion of creativity. I highly recommend that you check out this website called Sanzai Archaeology by Disnovation. Wonderful art piece that elicits the nostalgia of many mainland Chinese. Bird, the Chinese mobile phone pioneer, quickly found itself in real trouble. They had been big during the older licensing regime, but now they were caught in the middle. Below them, the Sanzai phones were overwhelmingly cheap while also sporting premium features like MP3 playback and dual camera support. And above them, the foreign brands' phones like Nokia, Samsung, and Motorola had superior technology, software, financial resources, and user experience. Bird, with its big marketing budgets, could not afford to develop their own technology. R&D never exceeded 5% of revenue. What technology they did have was limited because it came through their foreign partner, Sagem. Back in 2003, Bird tiptoed into automobile manufacturing. Bizarre. But then in 2006, they doubled down in an attempt to diversify. This not only failed as spectacularly as you might imagine it would, losses totaled nearly 600 million RMB, but also distracted the company from its imploding phones business. I call it the anti-Xiaomi. So, after sustaining brutal losses, Bird switched to real estate development, which I reckon is like retirement for Chinese companies. Easy money with little work. So far as I can tell, they're still around, but just a shell of themselves. In one way, China had something special, a thriving high-energy tech manufacturing industry. The issue, however, was that much of that vitality depended on being outside of mainland China's regulated phone ecosystem. And many Sanzai businesses argued that the marketing, technology, and regulatory burdens made it uncompetitive to go quote-unquote legit. Take the lesson of the greatest company of the bandit phone era, K-Touch, owned and operated by the ambitious Sanzai godmother, Rong Shou-li. Rong was born in 1963 in a rural village in Henan, and was often remembered as tomboyish and stubborn. In university, she studied internal combustion engines and first worked at a public research institute before quitting in 1993 to go into business. She first joined a mobile phone sales agent company, reselling Samsung and Dopod phones into China. In 1995, she bought out her boss and his unsold inventory and grew the company into a powerful distributor. Then in 2002, she took all her savings and founded Beijing Tianyu, or K-Touch, with the goal of making their own phones. At the start, the company struggled to do that, investing 8 months and over 80 million RMB into R&D. It put them on the verge of bankruptcy. Then, in 2005, she discovered MediaTek and its turnkey model. MTK dispatched a team to deal with any technical issues and got things off and running. K-Touch acquired a Chinese phone license and contracted OEMs to produce dozens of lines of cheap, low-cost phones. Rong used the familiar sales agent model to sell phones. In this arrangement, K-Touch first sold the phones in bulk to individual sales agents, collecting cash up front. The sales agents are then free to resell their stock to customers however they choose. Rong apparently liked this model because it was less restricting on the agents. Being an auntie from Henan, she enjoyed the art of the haggle, telling the Chinese broadcaster CCTV in a rare interview, "A handset distributor sells other people's products, but the marketing model and the prices are decided by the big foreign players such as Samsung and the like. The agents don't have a say at all, so selling is not much fun." In 2006, K-Touch sold 10 million phones, mostly to rural youths who liked the phones' slick looks and good build quality. In 2007, sales exploded to 17 million and 10% market share. And then in 2008, 24 million. But problems were on the horizon. In 2008, the Chinese government abolished the mobile phone licensing system altogether. Now, any Chinese company can go into the industry, and it unleashed a flood of brand new entrants. Rong knew what all this competition meant and decided that the way to beat them was to go legit. In other words, the Sanzai godmother wanted to climb up into the middle to high ends of the market alongside Nokia, Samsung, and the other foreign brands. In 2008, K-Touch released the K-Touch C800, the world's first 8-megapixel camera phone with 3x optical zoom. A legitimately well-made product, it was mainland China's first domestic phone to be priced at over 2,000 RMB, or $287. She also sought out foreign investors to add legitimacy to her efforts. In May 2008, an American private equity fund called Warburg Pincus invested $75 million for a 10% stake. This made Rong one of China's richest tech entrepreneurs, with an estimated fortune of 4.2 billion RMB, or $600 million. Rong told the media that her goal was to make K-Touch the Nokia of China, a term that I think was loaded with irony considering what was happening to Nokia itself at the time. The C800 hardware was quite good, but the software ran the Windows Mobile 6.0 operating system. Ew. At a time when the iPhone's popularity and groundbreaking nature was becoming rapidly obvious, this was not attractive. MediaTek, for their part, realized it had to respond to the iPhone somehow, and unfortunately they backed the wrong horse at first. In 2010, MTK chose to partner with Microsoft. They seemed to have thought that Windows Mobile was the safer choice, and that the Windows product was more mature. Unfortunately, Windows Mobile was not it. Android was, for reasons that I will get to in a future video. Powered by Qualcomm chips, Android blew away the MTK and Windows Mobile pairing. MTK's revenues dipped in 2011, partially as a result of business lost to the growing Google Android Qualcomm juggernaut. Frantic, they brought out new chips like the MT6575 and MT6577 to support Android 4.0 in early 2012, which restored MTK to growth and beyond. However, the lost years were more than enough to cripple many of MTK's customers, like K-Touch. MTK's decision meant that they had no choice but to first adopt Windows Mobile 2. But K-Touch phones like the E61, E68, and E608 failed to match up against Android. K-Touch did a phone with Android that is mostly forgotten, but then, bizarrely, pivoted to Alibaba's cloud-based Linux OS Alien, powered by an NVIDIA Tegra GPU. This decision was apparently driven by the belief that HTML5 apps will eventually overtake native apps. However, the user experience was apparently not quite there, and sales of Alien phones like the K-Touch W700 flopped, with 70,000 units sold versus a million expected. K-Touch's last relevant phone was in 2012. They then tried to pivot to e-commerce before undergoing significant layoffs before then fading into obscurity. Today, their headlining products are quote-unquote elderly phones with big buttons, large fonts, and long battery life. The rest of the Sanzai phone industry was by then fading away too. In late 2010, the Guangdong provincial government started cracking down on the illegal aspects of the Sanzai business model, IP infringement, counterfeits, etc. Meanwhile, new distribution models emerged, most notably the telecom operator-driven sales model, where telecoms subsidize a cheap but reputable smartphone to lock a customer into a long contract. Coolpad and ZTE were examples of low to mid-range smartphone brands that became successful and widespread via this method. The telecoms had widespread distribution into the lower-tier cities and the rural areas, and their subsidies leveled the playing field price-wise. And of course, in 2011, Xiaomi released their revolutionary phone, the Xiaomi Mi 1. They offered a well-regarded flavor of Android and a powerful Qualcomm chip at an incredible price, 1,999 RMB. Why buy a shady, unsupported phone when these far better options exist? The Sanzai phone industry lost its reason for existence, the super cheap prices and rural accessibility, and faded away. A few remaining companies like Transsion fled overseas to places like Africa, where they are now quite successful. If you recall correctly, two major suppliers, Intel in hardware and Microsoft in software, captured all the value in the PC supply chain, leaving nothing for the PC assemblers and other manufacturers. A similar thing happened in the Chinese Sanzai phone industry in the mid-2000s. MediaTek's fully integrated chips, R&D spend, and turnkey model helped it capture virtually all the value in that industry leaving just scraps for the handset makers. And those handset makers had no way out of it. They did not yet have the talent base to make a modern chipset, nor did they have the profits to fund the R&D anyway. So, while we look back at it now with a bit of nostalgia, in reality, the Santai were dysfunctional, desperate companies that only can exist because they didn't follow the law, cut all sorts of corners in a rush to market, and skipped all kinds of essential long-term things like R&D. In the evolutionary tree of Chinese phone history, they ultimately constituted a dead end. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.